Recorded commercial-free community radio for North Idaho. Please become a member today at krfy.org.
And good morning. Welcome to the KRFY Morning Show for this Wednesday, October 26th. I'm the host today, Chris Bessler. And today we're going to be taking a look at the upcoming November 8th elections. We have a couple of keen-eyed observers here that are going to help us parse out what's going to be on the ballot and what people should be watching for. We have Ben Olson, publisher of the Sandpoint Reader.
Thanks for having us.
And Zach Hagedone, editor of the Sandpoint Reader. Zach, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
And we're going to jump into election stuff here and find out what's going on with the election in just a minute. But first, let's take a look at some things going on around town, starting with the weather. And folks, rain. Every day for the next, the Weather Service has it out 10 days, a chance of anywhere from 80% to 20% chance of rain each and every day. Highs in the mid to higher 40s and lows down around mid to lower 30s, although I don't see a prediction for freezing in this forecast we have for downtown Sandpoint. So, actually, rain is good. We live in the Northwest. We like rain, right?
Yes, we do.
As for things going on around town, hey, I want to mention I caught the little live concert last night. Ben, you were actually playing in that.
Yeah, that was this is called the wraparound here, where you'd play on KRFY the night before and then you get up in the bright early morning to talk about the election.
So that's a concert that KRFY is sponsoring at the Little Theater once a month, and getting local bands to come in and play for an hour. They're broadcast over the radio. That's from 8 to 9. You guys played, and of course they had a small crowd inside. That we're not really pushing a big crowd in, for these events, but there are always a couple tickets available. So I think the next one will be in about a month. I'm not sure who we have lined up for that, but you want to listen for the KRFY's little live concerts happening at the Little Theater.
It was a lot of fun, actually. Yeah. Yeah, Jack did a great job putting it on, and Paul Gunter did the sound with the festival at Sandpoint. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. There's probably 20 people sitting there in the audience.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. It was cool to hear it over the radio. I wasn't in there in person. As for other things going on around town, of course, there's a ton of things going on in this town. We have Halloween parties. There's a big one at the Bonner County Fairgrounds, actually, on Saturday. Actually, it's on Friday, October 28th. From 5:30 until 9, I think that is. So that would be a fun thing to go to with the kids. At Hickey Farms, they're having their closing day, and they're also hosting the Crosstoberfest and Beer Fest on the property there. That's happening on Saturday. There's a Sandemonium Light event that's happening on Saturday. A bunch of live music happening around town. There's some fundraisers, Pints for Polio. You want to see what's going on? Oh, I got to mention this one. Cade Prophet Memorial Productions is putting on a play, Misery. That's taken from Stephen King's book, and I think there was a movie on that as well. That's going to be at the Panda. It's running Friday through Sunday each day, and that's going to be great. It's going to star Kate McAllister and Ken Wood, both very accomplished local actors we have here. So you might want to catch that.
That's going to be a great one.
Yeah. Yep. I think we already got our tickets, actually, for Friday. And you want to see more about what's happening in Sandpoint, go to our website, krfy.org. Click on the community calendars and get details, times, places on all these and see a ton more that I haven't even mentioned. You can also see that on Sandpoint Online, which provides the calendars. And that is what's happening around town. As for other things, well, air quality is good. It should be. And the fires are getting tamped down. Happy to say all this rain is really helping with that. And that's your sneak peek for the week, folks. With that, let's get into today's talk on the upcoming elections, which are happening November 8th. Although I'll say early voting is happening right now, and you can vote early if you go to the Bonner County Elections Office. It's in the County Administration Building. The voting happens from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. each weekday between now and, not this Friday, but next Friday, November 4th. And then after that, you need to wait until Tuesday the 8th in order to vote. But early voting is great. I don't know if you guys do any partake of early voting, but it's pretty nice to be able to just kind of take it off.
I actually have already voted by mail. I love it. I just fill it out at my dining room table and then send it off. It's beautiful.
I'm old school. I go to the polls.
Yeah.
I love going to the polls. I like to see the poll workers, and I like to get a sense for how many people are coming out early in the morning. And
yeah,
it's just a good civic experience.
I'd like to go to the polls too, but and I've never had to wait more than a few minutes at the polls. You see pictures of people waiting in these long lines in other states. That's not the case here. You can get in and out and vote in just a few minutes in almost any of these precincts. So you can see where to vote also. The County Elections Office has a website, they call it the Election Hub, as well as Sandpoint Online has a page called Election Central. It's got a ton of details and links to the polling place addresses, as well as the tools that the Secretary of State provides at Vote Idaho. You can check and see if you're registered to vote. You can punch in your address and see your polling place on the map. You can request an absentee ballot there. Absentee ballots must be returned to the election office by 8 p.m. on election day. So if you're going to do an election absentee ballot, make sure that it hits the mail in time to get there for that, or you can drop it off at the county office as well. So that's kind of the warm-up on how and where to vote. And by the way, you can no longer pre-register to vote right now if you're not registered, but you can, if you've lived here for 30 days, you can register at the polls when you go to vote. You have to take identification and a proof of residency. Well, something like a utility bill or two or three, that's what I'd take. And the Bonner County Elections Office can answer questions about that. You can get their phone number from their website, but I'll give it here, 208-255-3631. So let's turn to the races. It's kind of a sad, for a general election, it's kind of a sad number of candidates locally, at least. We have only one contested race for a state Senate, but there are other things that are important to vote on. There are races for governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, treasurer, controller, attorney general, superintendent of public instruction. There's one U.S. Senate seat, Mike Krapels, is up, and also our first district representative is up for election. And there are a couple important ballot measures to vote on, one if you live within the city limits, and one if for the whole state, it's a proposed constitutional amendment. So let's dig in on some of this stuff. Our single contested local race is Republican Scott Herndon, who you'll see on the ballot. He's opposed by the independent Steve Johnson, who you won't see on the ballot because Steve Johnson is running as a write-in. If you wanted to vote for him, there's a blank line below Steve Scott Herndon's name. You would write in his name and color in the box. But at least we have a choice. So that gives voters a choice. The sad thing, and I'll throw this out to Zach and Ben, is that we haven't been able to compare those two candidates side by side. Herndon turned down our invitation to come in and be with Scott Johnson, Steve Johnson last week here on KRFY. So we went with just Steve Johnson, which is too bad because I would have appreciated if we would have had his opponent in here. They could have tested each other's ideas and philosophies. But Ben and Zach, what are you seeing? Do you know any place where Scott Herndon and Steve Johnson have appeared together?
Not in the Sandpoint Reader.
No, not unless they happen to go shopping at the grocery store at the same time. I think it is sad, Chris. I think that part of running for office, you not only have the duty but the obligation to communicate with your constituents via the media. And it's just frustrating because it's a trend that you see, you know, going all the way up to you know, Brad Little refusing to participate in debates in the primaries for the governor gubernatorial race. It's a trend you see with a lot of candidates where they just kind of shut down and say, I'm not going to participate in these traditional forms of transparent, you know, these ways in which we can, you know, sharpen our sticks against each other and help for the constituents to understand a little bit more how we feel on the issues. And there's this insulated quality of politics now that's growing, where they communicate just via their social media and their own personal channels. And it's frustrating because I think part of being a journalist is putting questions to candidates that both defines their positions and also helps inform people what they may not support. So yeah, it's an ugly trend that I see growing.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just this case, as you mentioned. The governor wouldn't debate, and I think it's because it's a strategic question for these guys. If they think they have the upper hand, they're not going to give any light or air to opponents.
Well, that, and they just want to have top down control of their narrative. And that was the thing that we experienced with Scott Herndon. We invited him to participate in an open interview with me to be printed in the paper. It wasn't going to be a Q&A style kind of thing. It wasn't going to be a traditional candidate questionnaire type thing. And he initially agreed to participate only if it was a set of emailed questions that would be printed verbatim. And when we responded, like, that's not how we're going to do it. We're going to have an open conversation, you know, one-on-one, either over the phone or in person, you know, which would have been great. And you're not going to see the questions in advance necessarily. I mean, you might see sort of a general thrust of where the interview is what's going to cover, but I'm not going to give you precise questions, and we're not going to print your answers in giant block quotes. And he backed out after that. And that's sort of the trend that Ben was referring to, is that these candidates don't want any sort of lack of control over their messaging. They don't want any sort of filter other than their own, and they only want to use their own established media channels, which is usually their self-selected social media or newsletter subscribers or followers. So what you're seeing is just these little information silos being erected by these candidates that they can then disseminate their prepackaged sort of scripted talking points over and over and over again, filtered down through their own information filters to keep away any kind of debate. You know, no one can challenge you if you're in control from cradle to grave of what your story is and what you believe. And, you know, you can just dismiss any opposition. You can dismiss any counter argument, anything you want. I mean, you live in your own fantasy land at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really unfortunate that they're not participating in that way because, made the comment, you know, they sharpen their sticks against each other. And that's how we get at better policy from our government, is by these guys having to answer to each other, and they're not doing that, or answer, be accountable to the people through through the media and through questions that reporters might ask and test their positions on these things. But when they say, no, you have to run what I write or tell you verbatim and no questions, then it takes away that ability.
Well, it becomes the source, you know, they're driving the bus at that point. And that's not how journalism works. That's not how journalism has ever worked. You know, nobody coerces us or goads us into a certain style or form. And that's the beauty of the free press. You know, we are able to ask the hard questions, the easy questions, the questions, the expository questions. We're able to ask those questions of candidates without, like Zach said, without that filter taking all of that out of there. And their supporters might think, well, this is just them trying to take control of the narrative because the media is spinning their words out of control and this and that. And, you know, I'm not going to say that all media members are as diligent as others, but I have seen very few examples of a bona fide member of the media deliberately spinning somebody's words or misquoting somebody for an effect. You know, we take our job seriously. And when it comes to elections, we spend a lot of time discussing which tack to take, how to be fair, how to make sure everything is equal. it's astounding how much time we spend on this stuff. And to have somebody just say, nope, not participating, it's frustrating. Mm-hmm. Not only for us, but for the constituents who want to know.
Yeah, the voters want to get informed on this stuff, for sure. Yeah, in our case, where we invited both Scott and Steve in for an interview, it would have been completely unfiltered. Scott Herndon and Steve Johnson both control exactly what they say. So it was disappointing from our point of view that he declined to participate there. On the other hand, you know, strategically, just like with Brad Little, I can understand it. They want to win the election. They don't want to give air to their opponents. So I guess the big question here would be, first of all, in the primary election, Scott Herndon did run a very aggressive campaign against the incumbent Jim Woodward, and I'm sure you guys received it too. I got a ton of mailers that were basically all negative campaigning against Woodward. And, you know, what was your take on the way the primary came off with the type of campaigning that was done?
Well, I think last time, Chris, you and Lindsay and I were in here talking about the May primary. And I think that Herndon's campaign, which, you know, has been described variously as dishonest, as a smear campaign, as overly aggressive, didn't win him any supporters, you know, who wouldn't have otherwise voted for him. I think it was great for the people who already liked him and who wanted to see him kind of, you know, own his opponent. But I think it really did turn off an awful lot of people who, you know, may or may not have been willing to vote for him. I don't think that it endeared him much to the Jim Woodward crowd, which, you know, let's not forget, are Republicans as well.
Yeah, those are the more conventional or traditional Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to think about it sort of broadly, you could say that there, you know, there's ideology conservatives and there are policy Republicans. And those were the two camps that were really going at it in that primary. And it may well have galvanized some of that sort of policy Republican crowd to realize that they don't want this ideological conservative, you know, trouncing their guy. And there was a lot of sort of unmet frustration after that primary. And I think that as the weeks and months went by after it, we had a letter to the editor in the paper that sort of alluded to this, is that a lot of folks who didn't vote in the primary realized they'd made a mistake by not voting in the primary. I mean, I think a lot of people just sort of assumed that Jim was going to take it. Because Jim Woodward had done very well in all the past elections he's done. And he was unopposed, you know, in one of them. In one of those elections, one of the primaries, I want to say it was the one before this, he was unopposed and he still pulled 9,500-something votes. Those people didn't show up in those numbers in the 2022 primary. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of those people who didn't show up, just thinking it was a foregone conclusion, said, wow, we really probably messed up here. and we had a letter that said that. So yeah. I think that, to make a long story short, Herndon's really aggressive, kind of historically aggressive campaign may well have ended up hurting him more than it helped him.
It may hurt him in this election.
In this election, yeah. Absolutely. And it wouldn't have mattered if we didn't have this write-in. Mm-hmm. I mean, those people would have been angry and they would have gone home and sort of been, you know, sour grapes on November 8th. Mm-hmm. But now they have a choice, you know, with the write-in from Steve Johnson. So that campaigning may come back to bite him now that there is an alternative that isn't on the ballot, but, you know, people can still vote for.
Mm-hmm. Well, the very existence of a write-in candidate, I mean, I interviewed Steve Johnson on Friday for Thursday's edition of The Reader.
This coming Thursday, tomorrow.
Which, you know, we obviously, as we said before, we offered Herndon the same opportunities and he declined. But, you know, Steve Johnson said to me himself about the backlash from the negative campaign that Herndon waged against Woodward. He's like, I am a product of that backlash. You know, I decided to run, switch races to run as a write-in just because of that, because there were so many angry people. And he felt a calling to say, you know, we have to have a choice here. And so, I mean, just that alone, the campaign that Herndon ran, it ruffled a lot of feathers here. Mm-hmm. in our district. And, you know, writing campaigns are historically difficult. I was unable to find any precedent before in Idaho where a write-in candidate won in a legislative district 1 And I mean, if you look at a recent race just for the county sheriff in 2020, when Cindy Marks ran as a write-in against Darrell Wheeler, that was a pretty robust campaign, but nowhere near the level of the Steve Johnson campaign against Herndon right now. But I mean, she got almost 9,000 votes to his almost 18,000. You know, it's almost a 2-to-1 scale there. So it's a huge uphill battle. That being said, I have never seen so much support for a writing candidate in my life. You know, you can't drive a block without seeing 10 Steve Johnson signs in Sandpoint alone, but it's a big district. We go all the way to the border. And yes, so it is. Hard to predict what's going to come out of that.
It does take in all of Boundary County and most of Bonner County down to an area around Blanchard. Yeah, so that would be the question, you know, is running as a write-in, he's going to have to perform a kind of a historic feat. The one case I can think of where a write-in won was Lisa Murkowski in Alaska. And she ran as write-in, but she had a ton. She had been the incumbent. She got beat in the primary, which kind of goes to how primaries can be swayed because a lot of voters just don't show up. And so an energized minority gets in there, and they can get their candidate on the general election ballot. But she pulled it off. That was like 8 or 9 years ago, I think.
Mm-hmm. She had a very popular name.
Yeah.
But I think Idaho voters need to understand, and a lot do, but I think we need to understand now that the general election is not essentially the election here in North Idaho. It's always decided at the primary. It's the primaries are so, so very important to vote in if you want your vote to count. Because there's not much, as you see, it's kind of a ghost town, this general election. We usually have candidate questionnaires with multiple pages of all the candidates. There's no contested races, except for this write-in race.
Yeah. Well, that's the single contested race that folks are going to see on the ballot. I'll rattle off the other races that they'll see on the ballot. For county commissioner, they're going to see Asia Williams, uncontested there. Also, Luke Ahmet, County Commissioner, District 3, Asia's District 2. For Bonner County Assessor, Grant Dorman is uncontested. For Bonner County Clerk, Mike Rosedale is uncontested. Clarissa Koster is uncontested for Bonner County Treasurer. And Bonner County Coroner, Robert Beers. So you'll see them all on the ballot, but there's nobody else to vote for. There's not even a line to write a name in because you have to be certified to run as a write-in, which Steve Johnson did in the case of his run against Scott Herndon. I will say there is one ballot measure that's of interest to locals. Specifically, if you live within Sandpoint city limits, you're going to get a chance to vote in favor or against a proposed increase in the local option tax for tourist lodging within the city. So the language here is that it would increase the current 7% tax that tourists pay when they stay in a hotel room to 14% and extend its life through 2035. Those revenues would be raised for public safety services, infrastructure, street paving, parks, and sidewalks. I haven't heard much about this, really. So what is your guys' take on this? Do you think this is going to pass? And question I had, should the city be pushing it out there more? Are they campaigning as part of putting up these ballot measures?
Well, we did a pretty lengthy article about it when it was first introduced, and we reported on it again when it was passed earlier in the summer.
When it came up in the city council.
Yeah, the city council. When they approved the ballot language, I should say, and voted to put it on the ballot. Should they be pushing it out more? I mean, yeah, sure. They should be buying ads. they should be.
they need to make their case for why this is a good idea. And, of course, the case is that, you know, tourists, I think our tourism lodging tax is lower than a lot of cities.
Yeah.
And this money will be used to offset services that tourists use, but also locals. And locals pay for the majority of those services that tourists use.
And they've made some arguments. You know, the mayor is very much in support of the measure. He's part of a group of mayors around the state, which all represent sort of resort towns. And he's been working pretty closely with those mayors over the past at least year and a half. on a raft of different issues, but mostly, you know, related to housing.
Sorry about
That's
that.
Okay.
We have our first caller.
Was that the mayor calling? Yeah, so, you know, Mayor Shelby Ronstadt has been working with a lot of these resort city mayors from around the state on all these different issues. And a lot of it sort of revolves around that elephant in the room of housing and housing prices. And what he reported back to the council when they first sort of introduced this notion of increasing the so-called bed tax from 7 to 14% was that even if we do that, we're still below what a lot of these other cities do. When it comes to their own tourist tax, you know, calling it a tourist tax sometimes makes it sound a little bit more palatable to people who are, you know, just sort of generally anti-tax. So you can call it a lot of different things, but really it is what you just described, Chris. It's you know, taking a pre-existing tax where you siphon off a certain amount of dollars from people who are doing short-term stays in town, whether at a hotel or a motel. It also includes, you know, sort of Airbnbs and vacation rentals and things like that. Then you allocate it toward supporting the services that those newcomers or visitors, I should say, short-term visitors, are impacting with their presence in the town, and you increase it. You keep that initial 7% in place. This was an important point that the city tried to make, was that they're not going to be taking money away from public safety and, you know, the things that current 7% is already going to. That's going to stay in place. The additional 7%, should it be approved, that chunk of money will go toward, like, infrastructure stuff.
And public safety and those other things
that
they rattled off in there. What you can see, if you look on the sample ballot, you can read that language yourself. I will say that the Bonner County Republican Central Committee is advising that people vote no on that. But I don't see any rationale on the
It
website.
Surprises me that they're recommending that, because...
I was too. Yeah, I think that there's a general push for any tax is a bad tax on that crowd, but I it's hard for me to find people that are opposed to this other than hoteliers and Airbnb hosts who don't want to have to charge extra. I think it's got a lot of support in town just because it doesn't affect locals very much, you know, as far as our pocketbooks. The positive effects out of it, you know, it's making the newcomers pay a little bit more equitable share for the services that they use. But I too was a little surprised to see the Central Committee, Republican Central Committee, advise against voting no on that.
Right. I mean, yeah, these things do cost money if we want to have streets and sidewalks, and so that puts the entire burden of paying for those things back on the city residents.
Right.
But I think it would just be a philosophical, you know, idea on their part that we have enough taxes.
It's the tax protest idea, right?
Yeah.
And well, and something else I think that might be interesting to think about with that bed tax increase is that sort of hidden, not hidden, but included within the rationale for it is sort of building in a disincentive for the expansion of short-term rentals.
Mm-hmm.
That's been a bad problem for a lot of resort cities throughout not only Idaho, but, you know, the entire West. Is that the housing stock in a given resort community gets gobbled up by, you know, either second home buyers who then, you know, turn the house into a vacation rental, or even corporations from out of state will buy up just tons and tons of single family homes and then turn them into essentially zombie homes that are rented out to, you know, short term renters. And by increasing the tax burden on those rentals, the city has come straight out and said, you know, we hope that this will, in effect, become a disincentive to the proliferation of these things.
Right, and those homes could instead be used for workforce housing.
Well, exactly. I mean, we keep talking about how we have a shortage of workforce housing. Well, it's because a good proportion of the homes that could be used for housing people who actually live here are being turned into revenue-generating centers for, you know, either people who have more than one home or out-of-state corporations or, you know, you name it, investors. So that's another component to this as well. In addition to, you know, falling on tourists, it's also kind of aimed a little bit at real estate speculation.
Yeah, and it has been traditionally low. I mean, the national average, I forget what the number is. It's almost 20%, right?
I see that when I travel a little bit.
Yeah.
I see a much larger tax tacked on to my hotel room than you see around here.
Right. Yeah, so I think it's just bringing things back in up into the norm a little bit. for a resort town like Sandpoint, which is pushing that 10,000 population, that's important. You know, I think it's important to be in line with the things that resort towns are traditionally support, which is a higher tourist tax.
Okay, so that is a ballot measure that voters who live within the Sandpoint city limits are going to see on their ballots. But the rest of the county is going to see a different sort of ballot. Everybody's going to, we're going to talk about some of the state races because there are a couple interesting ones there. Let's talk first about another ballot measure that people are going to see, and that is it is SJR 102. It's the proposed amendment to the Idaho Constitution. And this is to allow the legislature to call itself into special session. Right now, only the governor can do that. And this is kind of a backlash, I think you could say, from the whole pandemic thing that rose up when the legislature was and the governor were at odds. So, Zach or Ben, dig in on this one. What's the pros and cons on this constitutional amendment?
I think you should say it's backlash to the COVID pandemic. I mean, the Republican caucus specifically included reference to the pandemic in its official pro argument, and it's exactly like you said. I mean, it's allowing the legislature to call itself back into session at any time it wishes, as long as 60% of the membership in the House and the Senate deliver a letter to the president pro tem and the speaker of the House, and the governor has nothing to do with it. If the governor wants to call a session under his, existing powers, that would now be called an extraordinary session. But if the legislature calls itself into session, that's a special session. And it's entirely meant to, as the proponents say, balance the powers. They claim that the executive and the judicial branch are unfairly working year-round, and the legislature gets caught on the back foot because it can only meet during a certain time of the year. So they're essentially trying to say, like, we need to be able to work year-round as well. If you guys are going to be in your offices, then we need to have the ability to be in our offices too.
So it's odd to me that the legislature or the legislators are some legislators are pushing to have. I feel like there's a sense that they're pushing to have a year-round session now, which to me. I always appreciate Idaho's legislative session because it's pointed, it lasts for a certain amount of time, and then it's
about,
over
about
with
3 months, January, February, yeah. March, sometimes into April.
Yeah. Exactly.
Sometimes May.
And then the yeah. the real work happens in the committees and in the lawmakers' districts. But to have a full-time legislature, that's a different animal altogether. And I think the proponents of this are saying it's balancing the powers. I would argue that it's the legislature trying to wrest a little bit more power, which is something that we're seeing nationwide with state legislatures. But they're trying to wrest a little bit more power and the ability to call a session. It's basically a spite amendment saying, we don't appreciate not being able to do this during the pandemic, so we're going to make an amendment now. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to have it on the ballot.
Well, it's been called even worse than a spite amendment. I mean, it's been called a power grab, mm-hmm. straight up by editorials from around the state.
And probably the governor.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure the governor's not in favor of it, but there was an opinion October 16th that went around the state from Ben Yasursa, Bruce Newcomb, and Jim Jones, all, longtime Republican leaders.
Classic
in Idaho. Yeah. Who wrote, voters should reject the SJR 102 legislative power grab. Mm-hmm. And their arguments are the same, maybe a little more pointed even, than you will see in the opposition argument on the ballot. Mm-hmm. Their thing here is, like, this is it's not even a back door, it's a front door to the most conservative, radical elements of the legislature to hijack the agenda year round, and they could just bring any and everything they want to bring with no oversight. And the categories they suggest, like, they have a safeguard within the language that says, we can come into a special session, but only to discuss these specific categories, or I think it was like subjects or something like that. They had a very vague kind of word. And so the question is, what defines a subject? Like, can you say, we're going to have a special session on taxes. That could be anything. Mm-hmm. That could be 29 bills, like the last special session we had, which was supposed to deal with the education funding and things like that. 29 bills were introduced that had nothing to do with anything.
Yeah. Most of them did.
None of them. Yeah. Not a single one. Yeah. And it cost about $100,000.
When they call themselves into extra session like this, now you got the state has to pay travel expense and and lodging and stuff for the legislators down
it
there.
It costs at least $30,000 a day just to have them in the building. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And the fear is that if you give them this power to sort of convene whenever they want, it's going to turn into a shotgunning of just whatever election, like electioneering issues they want to get into the newspapers. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be to deal with actual emergency business. It's not going to be to deal with anything of any substance. It's going to be basically a political grandstand for the upcoming election, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And they don't care if these things get passed. They just want to argue about them, and they want to talk about them, and they want everybody to lose their minds. And
it's throwing stuff at the wall and seeing if some of it sticks. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you get a large attrition rate there, but some things stick and get through, and that's kind of that's a strategy I've seen. Is just keep pumping it out there, and eventually something's gonna work.
Yeah, and one of the arguments I've seen, you kind of referred to this, Ben, is that by design we have a citizen legislature, and a lot of the legislators, they can work their schedule to be down there for 3 months. But if it did incur a lot of extra sessions, or it kind of grew into be a year-round legislature, that would wipe out a lot of the legislators who are working people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you lose that citizen legislator with their take on all the policies that are important to people. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you get into this realm where people often have pejorative terms for this, but career politicians. And Idaho doesn't strike me as a state that embraces the career politician as much as other states. I think that we value our citizen legislators, and that it's a trend that I feel like if we start opening up the doors and allowing that the legislators to call themselves into session, we do open up the door into having more career legislators as opposed to citizen legislators.
And that notion of a of an irregular legislative session is deeply rooted in Idaho tradition. I was reading in one of these op-eds here that, in 1889, when the Idaho Constitution was being framed, they were specifically worried about having a full-time legislative body. Like, that was something that they were very concerned about. And they considered having a session every fourth year. Wow. That was where they started.
Yeah.
And then they went like, well, that might be a little bit too long between sessions. So maybe we'll do every 3 years.
Yeah, got business to deal with.
But, and then it was every other year. And then, it wasn't until 1968 that lawmakers, convinced the voters in a similar type of ballot measure that it should be every year. Mm-hmm. And now we're talking about, could be every month.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's the constitutional amendment that people will see on the ballot, SJR 102. Yeah, so let's go through the state offices. We've got about another 10 or 12 minutes here. For governor, we have 5 candidates that are going to be on the ballot. Ammon Bundy is an independent. Chanty Rose Davison, I may have her name wrong there. Constitutional candidate, Stephen Height, Democrat. Brad Little, our incumbent Republican. And then Paul Sand, he's a Libertarian. What's your take on this? Does Brad Little have any real opposition here?
I think that there's a lot of interesting stuff going on with this gubernatorial race. No, I don't think Bundy has the support to win this race. But you see a lot of, like, for example, the Bonner County Republican Central Committee, they put out a placard that said, here's who to vote for, here's who we support. They pointedly left the gubernatorial and also the lieutenant governor race. They left those off of there, and they made no recommendations. And I found that interesting because I don't understand why they would leave that off of there. It's an interesting case where I don't think that they want to support Little, but they find that if they supported Bundy, that might bring a little bit of a backlash because the man is, he's toxic in many corners in the state. He's an anti-government activist. Um, he's he's ruffled a lot of feathers. You know, he stormed our Capitol before January 6th insurrection at the D.C. Capitol.
I mean, swivel disobedience.
Yeah, you know, he got rolled out in a swivel chair in handcuffs and zip tied. So it's a race that I think is going to earn Bundy a lot of votes, but it's not going to come anywhere close to unseating Little. In my opinion,
how about the Democrat Stephen Hyde? Does he have a chance? And we should mention, our mayor ran in the primary. Unfortunately, he didn't get some paperwork done. He had to run as a write-in, and Stephen Hyde, he was going to run as a Democrat. Stephen Hyde won the Democratic nomination there.
Well, I read an interesting interview with Stephen Hyde in one of the Boise papers a couple months back, and he's an interesting guy. I mean, he's got a lot of ideas, but he is the first person to say he had no expectation to be on the ballot. I think he's a retired educator, and he was kind of put his name out there as sort of a lark, kind of. I think he does like legitimately care about, you know, the state and would actually serve, but it was not one of these things where he was coming out guns blazing and like trying to win. I mean, Shelby Rongstad, I mean, he was definitely in it to win it. He went out and fundraised. He got in the room with the right people. He had the right endorsements. He traveled the state. He spoke in Boise.
He campaigned hard.
He did.
That goes to the difficulty of running a write-in campaign there. Because he had to run as a write-in because he didn't get his name on the ballot.
Yeah. So, I mean, Stephen Hyde, I don't think, is expecting to be in the governor's office. And like Ben was saying, I mean, there's no contest here. I mean, Brad Little's going to take this by a mile. Mm-hmm. But that, like, a lot of it has to do with the fact that in the May 2022 primary, the only real races that the Idaho Freedom Foundation wing of the party, you know, the extreme right-wing Republican group, the only ones they really lost big on were these up-ballot races. I mean, McGeehan, you know, Janice McGeehan, the current lieutenant governor, she was running against her own boss, you know, Brad in the primary. She lost. That was a big blow to the IFF sort of right-wing Republican branch. Priscilla Giddings, you know, the Whitebird representative who was running for lieutenant governor, she lost. She was the IFF darling for that race. So I think that explains why the local Republican Central Committees, you know, in Kootenai and Bonner County at least, wouldn't endorse for those races at all, because those were their people, McGeehan and Giddings, mm-hmm. and they didn't get on. So now I'm taking my ball and I'm going home. Like,
yeah.
Okay. Well, lieutenant governor, we have just three candidates. Scott Bedke, Republican, Terry Pickens Manweiler, Democrat, and Pro-Life, who is an individual, that's his legal name. He's formerly known as Marvin Richardson, as a Constitution Party candidate.
I think he's been running on these tickets since I've been voting.
Yeah.
Pro-Life.
I remember covering Pro-Life when I was, I think I was still in college, for my college newspaper down in Caldwell. I think that might have been when Pro-Life changed their name.
Yeah. So, what do you see in this race?
I think, again, it's no contest. Bedke's the Republican, so Bedke's going to win. And it's a sad state of affairs when the partisanship in a state has reached this boiling point where any other party, whether it be Libertarian, somebody registers independent, a Democrat, they have such a hurdle to clear just to have a chance against a Republican, and it's a very one-party state. Mm-hmm. So, as I said before, the primary basically decides the election most years, with very few exceptions. And I don't see the lieutenant governor race being any different.
The other thing too about Bedke, though, is that he's one of these old like state house war horses.
Yes, he's been in the legislature for many years.
Yes, mm-hmm. And he's kind of your classic sort of rock-ribbed elder statesman type, and he's very good at working sort of the back channels, and he's got a lot of legislative support. Like the legislators themselves see him as a conduit for a lot of deal-making, and he's I wouldn't say a consensus builder, but he's definitely the kind of lawmaker that brings people together to hammer out a solution to certain things. And it may not always be the way that people want it to result, you know, but he's still kind of in that mold. And as lieutenant governor, of course, his position would be very closely tied to working with the Senate. And given what's going to be the makeup of the Senate after this election, it's going to be a very different Senate, a much more conservative, I would even say, you know, far right Senate. having somebody like Bedke, who's much more toward the middle, if there can be such a thing in the Idaho Republican Party, having him as sort of a moderating force on the Senate is going to be, I think, critical for how that body functions. So I think that it's in the interest, I think, of a lot of the lawmakers themselves to see Bedke as the lieutenant governor in that institutional role as much as in that partisan role. And Terry Pickens Manweiler is a very, very smart person. So that's unfortunate that, you know, like Ben was saying, that the partisanship is so extreme that you put a DEM behind your name and you're toast.
Well, let's talk about a race that might have a little more hope for a Democrat. That's Attorney General Tom Arkush is the Democrat. Raul Labrador is a Republican. And I give Arkush a little more hope here because a lot of Republicans are backing, a lot of the mainstream Republicans are backing Arkush.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing this, this, I don't know what you want to call it, the quote-unquote traditional Republican or the moderate Republican. I've heard them call reasonable Republicans. They're growing out of this backlash that's pushing right. And I think I've seen a lot of chatter about Arkush as well. I think he has a better shot against Labrador, but Labrador has the Trump card, which is that R next to his name. He's been a controversial figure in Idaho politics for many years, and he's kind of a table pounder instead of somebody who comes to the table. And that's like Zach was talking about with Bedke. There are the nuts and bolts kind of policy lawmakers, and there are the ones who like to pound the table and get people riled up about things. Mm-hmm. Labrador is somewhere between. I think he's a table pounder a lot of the times, but he knows what he's doing. And so I think that Labrador, in my opinion, I think he's going to take this race, but it's going to be a lot closer than the lieutenant governor or the governor.
And I don't think Raul Labrador has made a lot of friends among sort of the longer term Republican leadership. You know, you see Butch Otter, you know, former governor Butch Otter has endorsed Arkush. A lot of people saw when Raul got elected to Congress, you know, they were hoping that he was going to bring sort of this Idaho conservative bent to the Congress, but he didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. He did everything he could to cozy up to, you know, the Trump card.
Yeah.
Literally. Yeah. It didn't deliver hardly anything back to the constituents.
But he probably would still be in there if he hadn't decided to go for governor, if he just held his seat.
Well, and that doesn't earn you any friends either. Just kind of stay in your lane, Raul. I don't think that the sort of mainstream, whatever you want to call them, Republican establishment in the state appreciated that very much. Mm-hmm. They wanted him to stay there and actually perform a function in the Congress and maybe someday come back and run for governor. But he jumped his chance in the line is what happened. And so that's why you see them going the extraordinary length to endorse a Democrat.
Yeah. And that was the election, like, I guess, two elections ago that he decided to relinquish his seat in Congress to go for governor. Well, how about Secretary of State Sean Keenan, the Democrat, is against Phil McGrain, Republican. Your earlier words on the fact that the McCrain's got a R behind his name probably guarantees him there.
Yeah, I mean, if this were a contest, choosing Idaho elections on the general election ballot, I would win every time. And that's not saying much. All you have to do is just look at the ballot. I don't know much about either candidate, to be honest with you.
I know Phil from down in Boise. He was Ada County, I think he was Ada County clerk. And he's a very smart guy. I will say that for him. And he's not an election denier, you know. So that's good. You don't want somebody in the Secretary of State who believes anywhere on the spectrum of, you know, election fraud, you know, widespread election fraud, things like that. I think Phil McGrain would be a good choice, actually. This is a Republican that I think, you know, regardless of what's behind his name, I think he would be good in that office. He's testified before the legislature many times, and he's always been very even-handed,
trying to...
Yeah. And I've heard nothing but good things about him from other clerks around the state. Because he'd be the boss of the clerks, right?
Yeah, so. Right.
So it's an important position after the 2020, you know, election denial, which has swept the nation. You know, Secretaries of State, we're seeing races like the one in Arizona with Mark Fincham. who was a very polarizing MAGA kind of guy with ties to Sandpoint. That's another tangent. Secretary of State is a very important position right now, because leading into the 2024 election, we're essentially seeing this this road being laid that is giving the state legislators more power to choose the president. And secretaries of state who stand up against that pressure, those are the ones who are going to make a big difference in 2024, I think.
Okay, let's touch on one more state race, and that is for superintendent of public instruction. This race was interesting in the primary. There were some pretty very conservative Republicans that ran. Debbie Critchfield won that primary as the Republican nominee, and she's facing Terry L. Gilbert. Any take on those folks, Zach or Ben?
I think that was another one of those races where the Idaho Freedom Foundation lost.
Yeah.
And it's critical. I mean, the superintendent of public instruction is always a critical position because the education budget is the single largest portion of the state budget. And it's become increasingly important, not only, you know, just for its sheer size, and then the issues around funding. You know, we got this $410 million funding package is going to move through. So whoever wins this election is going to be the one to administer those funds. But it's also become this just frothy culture war front, where, you know, we see this nationwide push, but especially, you know, very fierce in Idaho, to control what happens in the classroom from an ideological perspective, you know, talking about, you know, banning books and critical race theory and all these sort of red herrings that suck all the political air out of the oxygen out of the air. So having somebody in that position who's going to keep an eye on the dollars, you know, administer this funding, while also trying to keep a lid on all this sort of unfunctional noise that comes from pure political grandstanding. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've talked on numerous platforms about just the absurdity of critical race theory as an issue. And then I'll just come right out and say the purely anti-democratic notion of banning books, you know, in schools based on a bunch of flimsy assertions. Having somebody who can push that into the dark, dismal corner it belongs is going to be good. And I think both these candidates have expressed that perspective. Mm. And I know that Debbie Critchfield has been popular among a lot of the, you know, whatever we need to come up with a name for these people, like the moderate Republicans, the normal Republican. I don't know what you want to call them, but she's been sort of the favorite of that crowd. And again, you know, factoring in this partisanship stuff where you put an R behind the name, it's fairly certain she'll win, and I think that's probably a win for everybody.
Okay. Yeah, it's a win-win race, really. I think both candidates are very capable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have just a minute or two left. United States Senate is going to be on the ballot, as well as U.S. Representative for District 1. Our representative here is Russ Fulcher. He's facing Kaylee Peterson as a Democrat, Darian Drake as a Libertarian. Any likelihood that Russ is going to be unseated?
No. Russ started out as a, you know, he came into our office and gave us an interview. He was a very grassrootsy kind of feel to his campaign in the beginning. And when he won and he got into office, he pivoted to kind of being the guy standing behind the guy on TV talking pro-Trump talking points. And, you know, he's part of the whole sue the government over coronavirus and efforts like that. He's labeled himself as one of the freedom, quote unquote, or liberty, quote unquote, lawmakers. And so he has earned some followers that way. I have been impressed by Kaylee Peterson's campaign, honestly. And I think, I hate to give the same answer every time, but of course it's going to go to the Republican. I think she's going to get some good votes though.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, last office. We got to jump on this one. Senate, Mike Crapo is the incumbent. There are four other candidates going against him. The Democrats, David Roth, I think your assessment would be the same on this one, I'm going to guess.
Yeah. Crapo, you know, he's been in office for a long time. I've seen some of his ads recently, and he's doing the, you know, scare, fear ads pretty well. And it always alarms me a little bit when I see establishment politicians try to throw red meat at the base. And that's kind of what those were doing. So he's trying to get the base fired up. He'll win. There's not a chance he won't.
Okay. Well, Zach Hagedone, Ben Olson, you guys from the Sandpoint Reader, you guys want to throw out any last word on the election here coming up November 8th?
Just check out the Reader this week. You know, we've got a 2-page interview with Steve Johnson. I think he answered questions really well and defined his candidacy pretty well. And we really wanted to have both members of that race. Herndon declined participation. So, you know, normally we have a little bit more robust election coverage, but this year it's a little different. So this is our only offering of election coverage.
Yeah, because there's not much to vote on locally. But it's still worth voting, folks, because there are fewer races that are contested, but the races that are on there are indeed important. So, and I'll mention again, Election Day is November 8th, Tuesday, but early voting is happening right now. You can do that at the Bonner County Elections Office. Well, Ben and Zach, thank you for coming in and giving us the, you know, the 360 view here of the election, as such as it is. I really appreciate it. I want to mention one show coming up tomorrow here on the KRFY Morning Show. Our hosts Jack and Jim will be talking with Brenda Hammond about building community in difficult times. I believe that's a speaker they're going to have here in town.
Right.
So catch that at 8 o'clock tomorrow with Jack and Jim. And with that, we're going to head out for the day. We're down to just the last couple minutes. Ben, you played a live music concert last night. Here's one of the songs from your band, Harold's IGA. It's called Los Angeles 2003. It was a good song last night, so this one ought to be pretty good. You know,
there you go.
Right? All right. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us. Da da da.